Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2008 Home Education Conference held in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
My name is Elizabeth Merrill, and we're talking about leaping into mathematical and scientific study. At the end of this session, we'll have about 10 minutes for your questions. So if you'll hold those to the end, that'll be super. Now, you're here because you have a mathematician or a scientist in your home, and you want to know how to make the leap. What does it really take to get into the deep study? And today, we're going to talk about some of those elements, really bringing books into play, really choosing the books that you need for your family, incorporating really great discussions at your family dinner table or perhaps while you're driving around, and also to build the environment. Build the environment in your home that you need to make a great mathematician and scientist. When you're selecting a book for your scientist, we're looking for the living book, basically a book that's extremely interesting, that's well-written, that's accurate. You may find some of these in classics. You may look at Jules Verne and think about 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or The Journey to the Center of the Earth, or perhaps you're looking at a children's mathematical classic such as Alice in Wonderland that, you know, plays with all kinds of mathematical equations such as infinity and directions. You'll see this kind of thing in Alice in Wonderland. You may not know that Lewis Carroll wrote Alice in Wonderland to mock the ridiculous mathematical theories of the time. One of the reasons he wrote it, there's also a lot of social critique. But as you find these classics, also look for some of the new genre of math and science books. They focus a lot on the history and they bring a lot into your study. In addition, I find it extremely helpful to look at original documents. We always spend a little time looking at, you know, in our very first beginnings of study, we often look at Descartes. You know, we look at wax as he describes a ball of wax and what happens to wax. And this is just a little excerpt out of the huge writings of Descartes. But it's enough that we can play with it. We can get out a ball of wax and heat it up as we read this small excerpt and feel some of the power of Descartes without getting bogged down, because you want to keep the excitement alive. You don't want to make that young mathematician or scientist feel that these original documents might be difficult or drudgery. We do the same thing as we read Lavoisier. We also look at really current original documents. In order to find current original documents and study, you can go on an advanced Google search and ask for only documents that come up with .edu, and you might find some of these free scientific studies that relate to whatever it is you're studying at the time, whatever your scientist is interested in. Or perhaps you have someone in your family or a friend who's a professor or who's in school, and they have access to a huge database of these original documents. Then you can go through and handpick from hundreds of documents. Again, find something that's a little bit challenging but fun. And just take a little excerpt. Pull out the pieces that are most interesting so you're luring them into the study instead of making them feel bogged down. So that's a really great way to bring math and science in, is to use these books and this literature. As you're selecting these books, you really think about who is the identity of my young mathematician and scientist. And you have all the benefit being a homeschool family. You know your student like nobody else. Often they have a certain subject they want to study. Maybe your student is into dolphins or bats. We went through a bats period at our house, you know, where suddenly they're discovering things about bats. Or rocks. Maybe your student is studying rocks. What is it that your student is studying? Anyone have any? Dinosaurs, of course, great. You get into a subject, and as you look at the subject, you select books that will help with the subject, but you also select books that are just going to help you understand scientific principles. So you're going to cross a little bit. You're not going to just read about dinosaurs, but you're going to pick out some things that are also fun that are going to help you understand principles that will work in the field of dinosaurs or any other scientific and mathematical field. And as you look at your scientist and you see the identity of this child, you're going to do two things. You're going to feed their interest. You're going to help them. Okay, you love dinosaurs? We're going to study all about dinosaurs, learn their names, learn everything that we know about dinosaurs. And in that element, you're building on their strengths, what they love. But since you are their mentor, and you know that if they really want to become a dinosaur scientist, they're going to need to also shore up their weaknesses. So as you do that, you're also going to direct their interest. You're not just going to focus on this. You're going to say, wow, in order to be a dinosaur scientist, there is a place in science where you're going to have to know math. If you want to find a fossil, you need to be able to predict where a fossil might be. And in so doing, you're going to be able to understand the mathematical concepts of our planet. You're going to need to understand the stratosphere. You're going to be able to point to a spot. And there's some great examples of this recently. The Tiktaalik fossil find up in Canada. The scientists basically pointed to a spot on the globe and said, I believe this is where I'll find the fossil. He went straight to it. After 3 years, found this fossil. It was exactly where he expected it. And it's this idea to predict that will help your scientist understand the need for mathematics, because you use equations to decide where this is going to be. You use concepts built with equations. So you can kind of build this into your mathematician and your scientist study. Since you're this long-term mentor, you'll also want to look for some mentors that build just that scientist. Perhaps you would look for somebody who is studying fossils if you're going into dinosaur study. Or in my own case, I don't even know if I had expressed an interest in nutrition at the time. I can't remember, but my mother was so wise. She took me to a nutrition conference, a national nutrition conference, in Houston, Texas, when I was 9 years old. And it was this, you know, huge conference. We're sitting at the back most of the time, but I got to come in contact with some great nutritionists, and one of them made an impact on me for life. It was Dr. Roger J. Williams. He discovered pantothenic acid, which is our vitamin B6. He was a fascinating man. He had white hair and a white beard, but a twinkle in his eye. And even though they were doing all of these great scientific papers, I was 9 years old, I caught the enthusiasm. And I got to meet him, we took his books home, and his works changed me for life. And I continue to go back and read about his life and also make connections to nutrition and the humanitarian aid that he did. So I can tell you that even when I had a brush, just a rubbing shoulders with this man for a brief minute, it changed my life. And so as you seek for mentors, you don't have to think, wow, gosh, I need someone who can meet with my child every week. You may find someone like that, but you may also find mentors who just pass through your life but make a huge impact on you and your scientist. And so seek for those as you look for your scientists. We have long lists of literary resources. We'll maybe point out a few of them. In String, Straightedge, and Shadow, we talk about geometry and how it began. This is a great one. It's an out-of-print book, but it is printed separately by Whole Spirit Press now. That's written up there, so you can get it. All of this information will be on the Eureka Studies website, www.eurekastudies.org, so you don't have to feel like you need to write down those long lists of books. Another great book that we really love, perhaps you'd like to study Silent Spring or The Omnivore's Dilemma about our food sources. We also really enjoy A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe. And if you get this book and look at it, have any of you read this one, A Beginner's Guide for Constructing the Universe? Very fun. Yes, what we do is we see numbers, and every number will relate to a shape, and also some of the social history and the art that surrounds it. So you study the number one in a chapter, and you see that one correlates with the feeling of unity, because a circle has basically one side, or a point. It's basically a very small circle. And you look at how this idea of unity correlates to mathematical equations, but how you also see it used as symbols in architecture, in science, in math, and history. And then you look at the number two and see, wow, there's 2 points in two, and it's a line. And it's really about going somewhere. And you look at all of the relationships with two, and you look at the relationships of the number three, which the shape for three would be a triangle, and how it's the strongest architectural shape, how you can build on a triangle. And you look at four, and how in Hebrew studies, with the 4 points, you're talking about area. You're talking about the four corners of the earth, the four walls of your home, the four winds, all of these concepts of area. And it goes all the way through to the number 10, and you begin to see the math and science in every element of life, from art and history. It's a fun book to take your mathematician and scientist on a journey. But as you're looking at books, don't ignore the fun storybooks. They're already in your home. Go ahead and analyze those mathematically and scientifically. We look at the McBroom series. You know, McBroom heads out west with his 13 children, and he's looking for a great piece of property. When he wants to purchase the property, he is expecting 80 acres, which is promised in the deed. But as he tells his children to run here and there and look for it, he can't find the 80 acres. And the trickster Heck Jones, how many of you know this story very well? Okay. The trickster Heck Jones, who's his new neighbor, says, of course, it's not about the 80 acres spread out side by side, as you might have expected, all spatially arranged on the surface of the earth. If you read the fine print, what this is 80 acres that is all stacked like pancakes, one on top of the other. And where your property is that muddy one-acre pond. And then it goes through, this series goes through the struggles that the McBroom family has, and they continue to meet these mathematical puzzles where you might have thought that your 80 were spread out on a surface, but actually they're stacked in a stack. He also see things like overlapping data where he counts his children, but since there are 13, Will, Jill, Hester, Chester, all the way down to little Clarinda, sometimes one child will run from the line and get counted twice. And so you can make those correlations with these very simple childhood books. This is a mathematical concept. Sometimes we see overlapping data, and when you see this overlapping data, you can then make the jump to seeing it in studies as well. It's a great way to correlate and connect your math and science. You'll also see a lot of mixed math and nonsense, which we also enjoy in the book, The Phantom Tollbooth. When we read The Phantom Tollbooth, there are math concepts that actually are supporting math, and there are math concepts that are really violating our mathematical principles. And the thing that might surprise us is that sometimes we see the truth more clearly when it's the math concepts that actually are violating what is true, that come up and, you know, slap us in the face, and we say, wow, now I understand that concept because it's violating the truth. And, you know, an easy situation that you can see that you can see this working with is that in math, we have a reflexive property where if we say let 1 equal 1, that 1 does equal 1. And that there's also this idea with the 1 equals 1 in math that when you take it to real life, you're looking at the quality of the number and the quantity. Well, Norton Jester plays with this a little bit because he says, well, in our book, if it sounds, we're going to do this with words. We're going to make the jump to 1 equals 1 with words. If the word sounds the same, such as the weather outside and whether or not you're going to do something. He's going to say, therefore, the words are equal. He's violating this principle of quantity and quality. And the whole world is turned upside down in this mixed homonym play as he changes things back and forth for the characters. So he says, basically, a bee equals a bee. So they meet a honey bee, and he's asking you spelling words. You know, all of these crazy things where we have this mixed numeracy. You know, a sentence in a trial is the same as a sentence in grammar. And you can discuss this along with many other fun mathematical principles. And as you discuss, you come to this idea that, wow, what's happening with our mathematical concepts is that they're connecting with life, and that the math concepts are actually paralleling what we see everywhere else. And you see it popping up in literature. We probably see this no better than in Lewis Carroll, who we mentioned already, Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. But you know his famous poem, Jabberwocky. Familiar with the poem? Yes. You know it's mathematical? Okay, maybe that's a new one, right? But why do we understand the poem Jabberwocky? Why does it make sense to us? It's because there's a math pattern. Just like we take an equation, as long as we have two pieces of the equation or two terms and there's just one missing blank, we can fill that in, right? We can show our students exactly how to fill in. If we have 2 plus something equals 5, well, we know that 3 fits in that spot. In the same way, Lewis Carroll has played with words. He's taken words that are no longer used, perhaps old Celtic words or words that we haven't heard, we don't know the definitions of. He takes those words and he fits them into the poem Jabberwocky. And because we know the pattern of our language, we understand syntax, it's like a missing spot in the equation. Therefore, we can analyze the poem mathematically. So we can say, Jabberwocky, 'twas brillig in the slithy toves, did gyre and jimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird, and shun the frumious bandersnatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand, long time the manxome foe he sought. So rested he by the tum-tum tree, and stood a while in thought. And as in uffish thought he stood, the Jabberwock with eyes of flame came whiffling through the tulgey wood, and burbled as it came. 1, 2, 1, 2, and through, the Jabberwock. 1, 2, 1, 2, and through, the vorpal blade went snicker-snack. He left it dead, and with its head he went galumphing back. And hast thou slain the Jabberwock? Oh, come to arms, my beamish boy. Oh, frabjous day, callooh, callay, he chortled in his joy. 'Twas brillig in the slithy toves, did gyre and jimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Now, you may not understand a lot of the words that are in the poem, but you can show your young mathematician and scientist exactly what the words mean by using the poem to fill in the blanks. Just like you drop a term out of an equation, you can fill it in. You can say, the slithy toves. Well, we know that slithy is an adjective. It makes sense to us. We can understand the story of the poem without knowing what every word means because we understand the syntax. We can say they did gyre and jimble in the wabe. We know that gyre and jimble are these compound verbs, and we can get the feeling of what's happening because we understand the great story. This is the great story of all time. Things start out calm. There's a conflict. There's a great monster threatening us. The hero goes out and begins to fight. He comes into conflict. He wins. He comes home triumphant. Things return to normal. We recognize the great patterns in literature, and we can see the mathematical relationships. So take the storybooks. Take the great poetry. Go ahead and analyze everything for its mathematical and scientific content. And then after you've, you know, thought about books, you've taken the step of getting books, we also incorporate great discussions. Discussions that help us leap into this mathematical and scientific study. Discussions are going to help us think outside the box. They're going to help take our young students and help them understand the natural flow and pattern of life. One of the things I need to clarify is that as we talk about some of the things we might want to discuss at the dinner table, remember to let it flow. We don't, you know, there's no reason to make you as an educator, you know, spend all day finding the great dinner discussion topic and keeping your family right on schedule. You can just discuss. You can say, wow, I wonder what it is. You know, we know reason is very important. We know critical analysis is essential to make a great scientist. Has reason ever gotten us into trouble? Do reason and the scientific method always work perfectly together? You can just pose some of these questions. And then perhaps you might want to think about things like you might want to bring some history into play where we say, wow, Aristotle believed in reason. Aristotle believed in reason. He didn't really have the scientific method to mesh with that reason. And he heard about Pythagoras, who lived, you know, more than 100 years before him. And Pythagoras made this wild mathematical theory. He said the earth was spinning around the sun. Aristotle thought that was completely ridiculous. That is just an extrapolation of an overexcited mathematician. He said, how could you take the math and say that? And so Aristotle said, I'm going to follow Plato, who said reasoning is best. Just ignore our senses and think about reason. And as it develops over time, as your family starts thinking, what's going on? What happened with Aristotle? Perhaps on another night, you'll talk about the Aristotle assumptions about the universe. Because Aristotle got down into reason and he said, wow, my great brain tells me that the earth is very heavy. That's a very intuitive idea. We feel heavy. The earth is at the center of the universe. That everything is going around the earth because the earth is the most important body, the most important celestial sphere. And that the earth is made of four elements. It's only made of earth and water and wind and fire. And everything outside the earth is only made of one element. And we're just going to call it this perfect stuff, this ether. And these are his assumptions. And if we talk about those assumptions around the dinner table, you might find some of these ideas and the principles coming out in your young scientist. Aristotle also said, well, things can't be moving around on their own. So these planets that are up in the sky are really pushed by angels or Greek gods. Some kind of idea like that. It's fun to watch young students struggle with some of these ideas. It may seem somewhat elementary or ridiculous to them that we have just this very simple idea, these very simple assumptions. They'll say, well, how could anyone believe Aristotle? But then you can go out and look up. Your student may look up some of the great arguments. Why? Why did people believe Aristotle for 2,000 years? Why did they hold to that? And those people who would believe that the earth was spinning around in space were mocked. The argument said, if the earth is going fast, and it does go fast, they had no idea how fast at the time. So it's, 66,000 miles per hour were going around the sun. But they knew it must be fast. If the earth is going fast, then why is it that when birds fly up in the sky, they're not left behind? They can't, they don't have trouble finding their nests. And why is it that objects don't just spin off the earth? And why is it that you don't see a parallax? If the earth is traveling around the sun, which they thought, oh gosh, that's perfectly ridiculous. Well, then when we look up at the stars, the earth must be at different positions at different times. Therefore, the stars are going to look different. Just like if you hold your hand out and you close one eye, your hand is in one spot, but then if you switch and you close the other eye, it appears that your hand jumps just because your eyes are in different positions. Well, if the earth is in a different position, the stars are going to look different. That's a pretty good argument, right? And that's what the argument that was coming up. Well, the earth couldn't be moving because we don't see that parallax effect in the stars. The stars pretty much looked to be in the same position. Well, it took a very long time to discover that the stars were ever so much further away than anyone could have imagined, that the parallax effect is so tiny that it took very precise instruments and thousands of years later to discover. So these fun little things that you can help bring into play. Now, why is it that if you discuss this ancient difficulty, this ancient struggle, it might help your scientists sitting at the dinner table? How's it going to help them as they go forward? Well, the same principles that worked as they're bringing forth the struggle to show the world the truth about our universe are working in our fields of science today. It's the same principles. And as we show students perhaps the way, the methods that scientists used, it helps them develop the principles for their own lives. Basically, the data was available. There was information that was in conflict with Aristotle's assumptions. But people weren't necessarily following the data. And so young scientists can see the benefit in following the data. They can see, wow, if scientists had really thought about it, they would have seen, we know that the planets vary in size and brightness, so they couldn't all be the same distance from the Earth at the same time. There must be some differences. And they could see that, okay, Mars is traveling around the sky, and then when it gets to a certain point, it looks like it's going backwards. Does that look like a perfect circle? You know, Aristotle said everything was in perfect circles. He said, here's the Earth in the center, in a perfect circle around it is the next planet, and the next planet, and the next planet. And everything's just perfect. It's made out of perfect material. It's a perfect ball. You can see there's a problem with Aristotle's assumptions when you look at things like retrograde motion of Mars. And then you can introduce your scientist even to some of the struggles with science and religion and help them see where maybe some missing pieces were creating a lot of hot spots for the scientists of the time. There were 6 scriptural references, which you'll easily find, but it's very similar to this one, where in Joshua 10, 12 through 14, it says, "And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed. So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and hasted not to go down about a whole day." This and the other 5 scriptures which talk about the sun rising and setting in the sky nearly cost Galileo his life. Because here they had scriptural evidence. And Galileo was saying, I absolutely believe the scriptures, but I suggest there may be another interpretation. I suggest that our great prophets are only describing, even if they totally understand everything about the universe, they're only trying to describe what happened to the people who are standing on the earth so that they will understand what happened. But his claims were not believed. And then you can also bring into your discussions, wow, what do we see in our own lives? Well, we have this article of faith. Says, we believe the Bible to be the Word of God, as far as it is translated correctly. We also believe the Book of Mormon to be the Word of God. And Galileo, wouldn't he just have loved to have this scripture? And he turned to Helaman in 12:15 and say, and thus, according to his word, the earth goeth back, and it appeareth unto man that the sun standeth still. Yea, and behold, this is not so. For surely it is the earth that moveth and not the sun. For this prophet who decided to write a little bit more really cleared things up. So these fun dinner discussions help bring students. When your mathematician and your scientist is going to be in banking on a career, they're going to come into conflict, or some areas that at least appear to be in conflict with religion or politics or things that they understand. It is so helpful for them to be able to understand that there may be information that is not available right at the moment. For them to see where it's helpful to follow the data. It may be very helpful for them to know where to anchor into the scriptures. And also to see where there may be more interpretations. As they follow the data, you know, Galileo had this great idea. He was like, wow, I can actually show some things. He develops a telescope. It was the best telescope of the time with 20 times magnification. And he says, I can turn my telescope to the sky and see that there are craters and mountains and valleys. I think I can see that in a harvest moon. Do you think you can see that? So it was just one more piece of evidence. He turns his telescope to the sky and he says, you know those things we see on the moon? Those are actually craters. Those are actually valleys. And so the moon isn't a perfect ball. So he turns his telescope again. And he says, well, there's Jupiter and I can see there are moons. And the moons aren't going around Earth, they're going around Jupiter. You see how he's using the data? And this pattern is so beautiful for these young mathematicians and scientists because they can see the pattern. And then they can say, wow, I'm going to take that into my dinosaur study. I'm not going to take that into my rock study. You take the pattern and take your scientist to the next step. He also saw when he looked at the sun, oh, the sun is not a perfect ball either. The sun actually has spots. The sun's got these spots, and the spots have areas where we know it couldn't be a perfect ball. So he comes up with some conclusions, and the conclusions are showing that Aristotle isn't correct. Do you know when we actually got mathematical proof that the Earth was in the not in the center of the universe, that we have a sun in the center of our solar system, which is just a tiny spot in our universe? The mathematical proof emerged in 1977. It took a very long time. But the pieces began emerging long before that. And it took a long time. I believe the Catholic Church apologized in 1992 for their treatment of Galileo. So, you know, we get to see some of these, and they become a little bit more comfortable with having faith in what is truly important, knowing their God as a great mathematician, having faith that it's going to work out, and following not just their intuition, but also the data that they're gathering. And then you want to build up an environment. We've talked about books and discussions at the dinner table. Well, you also have to have the environment where you can get hands-on. We think about some of the great scientists of all time. Well, there's George Washington Carver, and all he did is walk outside of his farmhouse into the woods, study the flowers, and he eventually, with additional study, became a great botanist. Thomas Edison, thanks to his extremely patient mother, was able to blow something up once a week at least in his basement and invent things. And he says he did it mostly out of laziness. When there was a task that he had to do, like the telegraph, he didn't want to sit there all night working on the telegraph, so he invents an automatic one. He invents all of these products. Or how about Nathaniel Bowditch? He was motivated by what was around him. His family members all went out to sea. He starts losing family members. He becomes motivated to have a very sound mathematical pattern for navigation through the seas. He doesn't want to lose anybody else. He has this environment of living on the sea and getting on the boats. Now, if you have a dinosaur scientist in your home, I'm not suggesting that you move out, you know, to the Paleolithic dig site, or if you are studying dolphins, you don't need to get on a yacht and live for 3 years while your scientist is studying dolphins. But books can take you where you cannot go. Go as many places as you can go. Get as many experiences for your young scientists, especially in the subject that they're studying. And it may change a few times. But get as much as you can. And then, of course, you're going to use the hands-on experiments. They may be very simple, but it's the principles. If we stick to the principles of the matter, then you can build that excitement and use those discussions to help your scientist think powerfully in their field. Now, some of the tool set items that we have for scientists. Well, observation. And you can do that regardless. If you're scientist is eventually going to be observing the small clues in the stratosphere, or actually on the bone of a dinosaur, to know what's happening. They can also gain that observation skill right in your backyard without the dinosaur bone, because you're building the skill of observation. My children love those tiny little composition books and the little spirals. One of my sons is never without one in his back pocket, and he just loves the fact that, he says, this is my nerd label. He's 16 years old. He always has something to write with a couple of pens, and he's got his book, and he doesn't shun the nerd label at all. He says it's a wonderful thing. And he writes down his observations. He writes down his ideas. They're journaling what's important to them. They're writing down questions, and then you can discuss and analyze, and you write down observations. It's great to observe a beetle. You know, you can probably find those big fat beetles in the spring just all over the place. And if your scientist will sit down and observe and try to see how many things, that usually propels them into the study of finding out more about it. Often it's that experience that makes them want to learn later. So we do that. And then we also want to make sure that they have some tools for experimentation. Now, I don't recommend going out and buying expensive scientific materials. You don't need to purchase a microscope necessarily. I have done that. I found it's not as helpful as I would have hoped. I've spent a lot of years in labs using great equipment. Even with the great equipment, it's frequently difficult to see what you need to see. In a home situation, I recommend highly a really good magnifying glass, the notebook and the pencils, a good list of kitchen tools, of course, measuring spoons, and a good food scale, which you can get for $20 to $30. Then if you need to see more magnification than you're going to get with a magnifying glass, which you can get, you can slice things down and get a pretty good magnification. If you really want a microscopic magnification, you cannot beat what you can get, you know, just looking up the microscopic pictures on the internet, because you're going to be able to see both compound light microscope pictures and electron microscope pictures. You'll be able to see microscopically. So you get your student down as close as you can into the small picture, and then let them go into that deeper study. Now, as a mentor, you have this mathematician or the scientist. If they're a dinosaur scientist, they may not realize, hey, I need math. I'm going to need math at some point. They say, if I'm studying dinosaurs, why do math? I'm happy studying dinosaurs. As a mentor who's going to be with them for decades, you can point out, yeah, remember you're going to have to predict? If you want to hold on to your dream to study dolphins, you're going to have to know. In order to be a dolphin scientist, you're going to be able to have to measure what's going on in the dolphin's body, why a dolphin might have gotten sick, what's bothering them, how fast they're migrating. When you tag them, how to take into account the variables that they're going to come in contact with. And that requires their math. And so you can help ensure them that that's one of their very important mathematical tools. And finding problems. If you want to give your scientist a tool, it's to have a problem. Just like Nathaniel Battich had a problem. He had a problem losing family members when they went out in ships. He didn't want to lose any more family members. He became the most precise scientist on the ships, and he used math to do so. So you have a problem. Clara Barton and Florence Nightingale had a problem with the way medicine and nursing were being taken care of for soldiers. That was their path to greatness. They had a problem. So maybe your scientist in your home will choose a problem that has to do with something in your family, or perhaps they'll feel a greater problem of the world. They'll feel this need to solve a problem. And then you can help do this work or play. I can't really decide if it's work or play. Some scientists are describing it as work and some are describing it as play, but it's really a mixture, because when you love what you do, your work is your play. When kids really play, they often play at doing what will eventually be work. Surely you've been out doing yard work with your kids and they were just, oh, we don't want to do this. And the minute you let them go, they ran out in the field and dug a bunch of holes and played a game with them. You know, when they love what they're doing, Their play is actually a form of work. And so you'll see this in these scientists. When they're playing, they're playing at being a scientist. I point to Kepler, and it looks a lot like work, but he loved it. And so in a sense, it was his play as well. But he spent 9 years working on a certain set of calculations. And he says, I could have died 10 times, yet he was just driven. I've got to know. And he looked at the data, and it didn't match what he really wanted it to be. His beloved theory that everything was going to be nested so beautifully in Platonic solids. Because that Mars thing, Mars was giving him all kinds of headaches. Mars is moving at a variable speed, but he was so faithful. He said, I want to think God's thoughts. I want to think the thoughts that God has after him. And I know God's signature is in the universe, so let's look at that. And so spurred on by this conviction, he follows a plan. And at the time, scientists are using this, 360 degrees we're familiar with, but every degree is divided into both minutes and seconds. And at the time, they're really only using minutes. So every degree is also divided into 60 minutes, which brings us to 21,600 minutes. So when they're looking at the sky, that's a lot of measurements. And so scientists said, wow, we can get better than 3 significant digits if we're just within 20 minutes. That's good enough. It just wasn't good enough for Kepler. He sweated over data losses of just 8 minutes. And he said, since it's not possible to ignore them, those 8 minutes point the road to a complete reformation of astronomy. So you see, he's working at it. It's this kind of idea that he works at that changes the way we think about it. He wanted the harmony in the universe. It wasn't what he had hoped for. What he came up with were the 3 laws of planetary motion. Newton also had this kind of idea. He said, I've learned by standing on the shoulders of others, his most famous quote, if I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants, like Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler. But then he describes his work as a sense of play. And Newton tends to come off as a very serious fellow. So you might enjoy this quote as much as I did. He says, I do not know what I may appear to the world, but to myself, I seem to have been only like a boy playing on the seashore and diverting myself in now and then finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary whilst the great ocean of truth lay undiscovered before me. Sounds like he's playing. He's loving it. Einstein had a very similar description of his own study. He said that, he could see these 2 theories, they didn't match. He puzzled over them. But then he also said, children who wonder about things like light and time and space are often satisfied with stock answers, and they never give it another thought as adults. But because I was a late developer, I first pondered such simple questions as an adult. And so I probed them more deeply and tenaciously than any child would do. What we find is that when we take our young students and keep that curiosity alive, keep that sense of wonder and the element of pondering alive, they become very profound scientists as adults. And so Einstein was playing with the funnest things of his day. The most precise thing was a clock. The fastest thing on the planet at the time was a train. He's playing with these things, and so he comes up with E equals mc squared and shows how energy is in relation to time in our universe. And so as we're supporting our young scientist, we're bringing a few things into our home environment. We're bringing books. Some of the books are going to be specifically for your child's topic, but then you're also going to suddenly begin to see where math and science is in everything you pick up. The concepts are there. The principles are there. And as you start to point them out, it's going to build this whole mathematical and scientific concept. You're also going to bring in those discussions at the dinner table, which it may take years to discuss certain topics, just bit by bit and piece by piece, naturally as they tell you about what they're doing in the day. And yet, it's those dinner table conversations that often build the principles that fuel them for the rest of their lives. You bring all of these things together, plus the great environment of a home where you can do hands-on activities, where you're working and playing as a scientist, and you have a great mission before you. You have a child or a student who can set out on a path and become their dream. One of the most painful things to see is when, you know, you want to be a dolphin scientist or a rock scientist or a dinosaur scientist, but after many, many years of study, they get there and they realize they don't have the basic skills, and suddenly they change their mind. Let your student hold on to that dream. We need the excellent problem solvers that are being taught in your home today. The U.S. desperately needs excellent scientists. And as your scientist sees God's plan, he sees God as the great mathematician and scientist who understands all the truth in the universe, they can chart their path and follow their mission and become the great scientist and mathematician that they dream to be. And it's this kind of wonderful mathematical education that changes lives and changes the world forever. And this I promise you. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen. Questions? How can you get your children to leap into these studies? Any questions here? Yes? If they're not linked yet, they will be. My IT man promises me that before we leave the conference, it will be linked. So, Kent, would you like to bring up the website for us real quick? That may be, you know, in your home is one way to study, but of course, many of you may find a lot of comfort in using some of the classroom material that we've prepared. You know, basically when we wanted more discussion than we're getting at the dinner table, we started the Eureka Club and the Eureka Studies, and all of that information is available to you on eurekastudies.org, as well as a very complete outline of, you know, as we trace truth, start of the universe. We go through the whole 2,000 years. We spend 16 weeks on it. And so you can access that very easily under the truth lectures and also under the fully annotated papers I've written on that, so you can find the pages and stuff. Yes?
I'm wondering, as a parent, science and math have always been a weakness for me. So what are things that you would recommend that I focus on first to get to this deeper kind of understanding so that I can lead my children in these kinds of discussions?
Okay. How, you're asking if you are struggling with math and science personally, how can you leap into this? Definitely, I would pick up some of the most interesting books for you to build excitement in yourself. And, you know, it may be some of the ones I'm suggesting here. Moving Heaven and Earth is a simple little paperback book. It's by John Henry. You know, it's inspiring. It brings up the struggle. And the funnest part about science and math study is seeing the struggle. Because what you want to do is you want to bring your student to the point of where there's a struggle in the field they're seeking. You know, they have to learn about what we know about dinosaurs or rocks or dolphins. They have to acquire that known knowledge, but they have to come right up to the edge where there's a struggle, or they can't be working. They can't be doing anything. And so looking at the struggles has been one of the most compelling parts of our scientific study, and really what's some of the most helpful. Any other questions? Yes. Okay, so basically what we do is we set a semester for our classrooms, and we consider this program, the Eureka program, a supplemental math and science program. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to want to abandon your math books, but that this gives you a reason to use the math books, especially if your students are struggling. Wow, I don't really want to sit down and do the so-called drudgery of the math book. If they have a reason, they have a goal, they say, wow, I am going to need to learn to be able to calculate a vector. I'm going to be able to know how to do calculus to do these, you know, this certain calculation that I'm going to need for my career. That will give them the motivation. And so, you know, our first semester we spend on truth. Is this what you're interested in? And And when you click on truth, it talks about what I expect of the students. And you can see some of the same elements that we've talked about. I expect that students will keep a journal, that they'll record their wonder and their curiosity, that they'll engage in some skits. And in skits, they frequently use the equations, and they use the stories that we've told in class. If they can act it out, they're really starting to know this material. We also involve movies and books. You can see I have the books that I've selected. There's no magic formula. It's fully flexible for your own needs. But these are the ones that I use in the first term, and they all fit in very well with our study of truth. I also have them present on whatever they're interested in, and here's, you know, Rene Descartes, our original excerpt for that first study. I also have on here some of this material is about our truth lectures. You recognize some of what we've just been talking about. What is truth? Building truth. What is an absolute truth? Each of these has a document that goes with it. So on the Phantom Toll Booth, you'll be able to see more of the concepts. You know, we just talked about one of those, the assumptions that one equals one. We also have ordered and unordered concepts, this kind of thing. Any questions more about this? The material that we have here? Yes? Yes, okay. Generally once a week for 2 hours is what we've been doing. Occasionally we'll do a class that is willing to do two times a week for 2 hours, but I think once a week for 2 hours is about what most families and co-ops can handle. And in the first half hour, the student leadership completely takes over, which you can read about in our resources. You know, how we elect class officers and their responsibilities, what our weekly classroom calendar looks like. You know, we have the student window you can see here on the chart. They have a gathering activity. We have class announcements, activities that we are planning. We also have in our student window a devotional. You can see, you know, song, scripture, prayer, quote, or poems. And then, you know, sometimes a student will get up and share something they've memorized, because we do a lot of memory work. In the first term, a lot of the memory work is not the obvious mathematical and scientific pieces. You know, it's a lot of the literary pieces that we're analyzing mathematically. But then in the second term, we see a lot more memorization. You know, kids who choose to memorize the periods of the earth, especially if they're in dinosaur science or Paleolithic, you know, or chemistry, they're memorizing all the elements. And those are listed on here as well under methods. After the student window, that's when the instructor takes over. I actually recommend that you have two instructors. I have done it alone, but I prefer it with two instructors, where you're alternating so that you can build the material, and we also have one instructor, you know, looking over work and managing the classroom while the other one's presenting.
I want to point out that this is kind of geared toward the homeschool co-op, this part right here. There are individual families.
That's right.
And even with a co-op, parents really should have a...
Right. In our co-ops, you know, it works great. We expect to have a student signature, a parent signature, and a teacher signature, three gatekeepers, very similar to our Temple Recommend program. So we have the student signing off on themselves. But it works great in families, too, and families have used this where they have a parent sign and then have a grandparent or another parent sign as well. And then we use it for rewards. We go on trips. You know, we tend to need some kind of motivation for them to actually complete a set of study. And I take them at the end of the year for a week to Zion's National Park or Arches. We've done both. You know, it's not an expensive trip, but it's very fun, and they tend to want to go, and they get their work done to do so. We try to have four small trips in the interim to kind of keep them on track. I prefer groups of 15 or less. You know, 10 to 15 is the best. I have done 25 to 30 students in the classroom. Basically, you don't have as much time to spend with each student. I definitely prefer the 10 to 15 students. That's enough to have some good colloquia, you know, to get some good information flowing, to have a lot of variety, people studying different things, so the students get stimulated in different topics, and it's enough to manage. Yes?
This goes through the whole school year?
We generally start in September, and we have our culminating trip in May. But, you know, the timeline is would be open for anyone. And families have been very successful using this at home. In fact, they've met us for some of the trips. We've had some families who just, you know, come together for the trip. So we haven't seen them all year. They've been out doing their own thing. Then at the trip, we meet them, and it's really fulfilling. We find out what they've been studying. You know, we hike side by side, things like that. In fact, our California groups came out and spent the week at Zion's with us last year. So, you know, that was really fun.
LDS Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.